I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Tomorrow is the President's Day holiday, and tonight we mark the occasion not with a discussion of the West Wing, but with a conversation about the office itself, its original design, its changes through time, where it stands today, and where it may be going into its third century. Of course, we cannot track the presidency's evolution without speaking of the men who have occupied that office, shrinking or expanding it by the circumstances of the day and their own very different goals and personalities. This is an ambitious project for an hour. And to make the attempt, we have three very welcome guests. From Boston University, the director of the American and New England Studies Program and professor of history at the College of Arts and Sciences, Bruce Shulman. Professor?
Great to be here.
Delighted to have you with us. From Phillips Academy, the Department of History and Social Studies, Dr. Kathleen M. Dalton. Kathleen?
Hello.
Welcome. And former Democratic Congressman Chet Atkins of Massachusetts, who served in Congress during the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Welcome, Chet.
Happy to be here, Ted.
This office, this presidency, it's not a king, it's not a prime minister, it's something that is unique in its time to America. And it was put together by the man who said, "Don't call me Your Excellency or Your Highness, I'm Mr. President." George Washington becomes president in 1788. There'd never in history before been such a position. What was his influence on the formation of that office?
Well, he was very careful not to act like a king and to avoid the trappings of aristocracy. But I think to define him as the definer of the office is perhaps not quite right. It's really Madison and the Constitutional Convention that really think about the office with checks and balances and limitations on it. So it's always meant to be not a temporary kingship, but the leader of a government that has limits on the power. It's limited power.
Washington really was extraordinary because his role and his strength was, and his influence was more by what he didn't do, what he didn't seek, by his extraordinary ability to limit his power, to limit his ambition, particularly when he came into the presidency almost by acclamation. And the opportunities for him to have centralized power, the opportunities for him to have set up almost a regency were absolutely enormous, and he rejected all of those. And I think that's the thing that he did that defines to this very day the American presidency.
Thank you, Congressman Atkins. Professor Shulman?
Yeah, I think that Washington's unusual and heroic status created certain ambiguities about the office of the presidency that persisted well into American history. For instance, he was made president almost by acclamation. Now we think of presidents as being partisans as well as leaders, as representatives of a party. But of course, Washington was president before there were parties or partisan competition. We also think of presidents as being the tribune of the people, the only office in the United States electoral system that is the president of all the people rather than representing a specific district or state. And yet, of course, Washington was not elected by the people. He was selected by an electoral college, which was then far less democratic than it even is today. Mostly state legislatures chose the electors rather than there even being voters selecting the electors to the electoral college as we have today. So I think the acclamation and the restraint that awarded Washington, the president, created certain ambiguities that have persisted. The presidency is an office, and it's also that's held by a man, everyone at least to this point has been a man, but it's also an institution that has changed dramatically over time. It's now a vast bureaucratic institution with a tremendous staff and it's and a wide reach rather than the very personal office that it was. And beyond that, it is, of course, a branch of government, part of this tripartite branch of government.
Ted, I think one of the things that is unique about the American presidency is the way over time, and I think a lot of this comes from Washington's influence, that there is, as Bruce mentioned, this sense of the office itself separate from the individual, and the enormous respect that Americans have for that office, and the way in which they can separate the person who holds the office from the office, which is very different from most other countries, and is also one of the things that has given the office and given the country such resiliency and strength. We've had some terrible scoundrels who have held that office, and some people who have been extraordinarily mediocre, to be kind to them, and yet the office has withstood all of those people and their tenure and remained such a central tenant of our system.
Kathleen Dalton, you had something.
I wanted to add to Bruce's point about the ambiguity. On one hand, there's an assumption with the presidency in this system that he has to be responsive to Democratic public opinion, and that it's a really good constraint upon the presidency to have limits set by public opinion. But on the other hand, it is an office that's hard to stop sometimes, and sometimes people have stepped beyond the boundaries, and it's been really hard to pull them back. I mean, the Whiskey Rebellion, probably looking back, George Washington may have overreacted a little bit. You really didn't have to take all those people in the army to put down these little scruffy farmers. And, you know, eventually he let Hamilton go on without him. But there are some moments where you see the presidency stepping beyond the boundary of what he should be doing. And Congress sometimes pulls him back. But the really truly democratic feature of the presidency is a lot of times the press keeps them honest, and then the constraint of public opinion. Right. So I think this is an ambiguity in the sense that it's an unlimited office sometimes. Well, but it is a limited, you know, we hold them back because it's a democracy.
The formal limits are, a lot of them are very vague and unclear, but one of the extraordinary things about the office of the presidency is, Kathleen, in all of those instances, going back to the Whiskey Rebellion and the troubles in Northampton, Mass, when they started out there, is that almost in every instance when the president has stepped beyond the appropriate level of their power, they've been pulled back by some other major force in American life, whether it's public opinion or the Supreme Court or whatever. And no matter who the president is, they only live over that line for a very, very brief moment before they're pulled back.
What precedents did Washington set in his 8 years with respect to the president's relations with Congress, president's relations with the judiciary? Any comment on that in setting up the structures we all later lived with?
Well, I mean, establishing neutrality and realizing that America wasn't a very strong country and having some realistic limits about what you could and couldn't do, having smart advisors. It was really good to have Hamilton as a smart advisor and Jefferson as a smart and having advisors who disagreed with each other can be very creative. So he had his own brain trust way back then.
But he also had, I think Washington had an enormous respect for other institutions and was willing to limit the power of the presidency in deference to other institutions, which, again, I think was an extraordinary achievement given the way he could have exercised power had he wanted to.
Professor Shulman?
Well, today we think of the presidency as the central and most powerful office in the United States government, but it wasn't always so. And certainly for most of the history of the United States, the Congress was at least on equal footing. And I think that part of Washington's restraint as a leader, he's someone that could have been almost like king had he acted in that way, established that kind of balance among the branches of government that really set the pattern throughout the 19th and halfway through the 20th century, perhaps.
All right. So Washington sets it up, and by the constraints that were imposed at the time, he was with colleagues who had been with him through the Revolution, and they saw to it, too, in a way, as I think you pointed out, Kathleen, that he maintained the office but did not not a rise above.
Though in some ways it was his successors, the rivals Adams and Jefferson, that established the relationships between the presidency and the Congress and the presidency and the courts, and the more enduring precedents. I mean, Washington, in addition to being this great heroic presence, was also somewhat unusual. I mean, he was not associated with party or faction. He was seen as above that. And it was those more factional leaders that kind of established that template you were describing.
I'm Ted O'Brien. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. And you're listening to Professor Bruce Shulman of Boston University, Congressman Chet Atkins, former Congressman Chet Atkins, and Dr. Kathleen Dalton of Phillips Academy in Andover, as we talk about the presidency on the eve of this President's Day. Well, I go back to a time when there was George Washington's birthday and Abraham Lincoln's birthday. And, of course, we folded them all into President's Day some years back. But let's talk about Lincoln. Lincoln is credited with preserving the nation. Did he do it by changing the presidency?
Well, emergency powers were necessary during the Civil War, and I think he showed not only how humane and caring and compassionate a president could be at a horrible time. He was quite a human being during this crisis, but he also took emergency powers in order to save the Union. So we look back and say, okay, he had to do that. He had to evict those copperheads, and he had to do a whole lot of things. So, I mean, he
suspend habeas corpus.
Right. He had to do that in order to save the Union. So I think he shows the emergency potential of the presidency. But he also, I mean, as a cultural leader and as an eloquent spokesman for kind of the kindest, most generous spirit, he was ready to extend forgiveness to the Confederacy before he died.
Lincoln, I think, more than anything else, saved not only the United States as a country, but the soul of the nation. And to some extent added a dimension of the presidency in terms of the spiritual leader for the country as well. And I don't think anybody's ever done it as well as Lincoln did, but at a time that was a time of enormous violence, of hatred, of divisions, Lincoln truly was the great healer.
He's a mystery to me. He is a mystery to me because he was a very wealthy railroad lawyer and a very tough man. And yet he was this combination of almost conflicting feelings.
In some ways, of course, it maybe makes us rethink our expectations about presidents, since, of course, Lincoln was this, you know, more or less unknown country lawyer, had served only one term, not especially successful in the U.S. Congress, and had had a losing campaign for a U.S. Senate seat before he became president, and yet we all acknowledge his greatness, while many future presidents that seemed very highly qualified for office, George Bush the senior, Herbert Hoover before him, don't do so well when they get there.
But anybody who had watched the Lincoln-Douglas debates couldn't have helped but seen the enormous genius of Abraham Lincoln.
He really has the power of words, and he's eloquent, and but he had a good crisis to make him a great president. And that's the thing in the rankings. Whenever we talk about the rankings, you always get ranked higher if you have a really big crisis happen during your presidency.
He oversaw the single most deadly conflict in our history in terms of loss of life in proportion to population. What was his staff like? Did he do it by himself? I know at one point he virtually shoved McClellan aside and said, I'm going to take over this commander-in-chief's role.
Well, he more or less did it by himself. I mean, there was, there was just a secretary, a couple of secretaries. And in fact, you know, up until the Civil War, when the national emergency made it unsafe, whenever a prominent person visited Washington, they expected to meet the president and shake the president's hand. They went to the White House and did that. So that
sort of the same way a large contributor does today.
You mean you could get into the Lincoln bedroom
about
$50,000?
But I mean, there was no executive office of the presidency as we call it now, and so I mean, with some exaggeration, yes, he did do it pretty much himself.
And the key people around Lincoln were extraordinarily weak and incompetent. I mean, that's
Well, John Hay and Nicolay were not incompetent. They were just young kids who were his secretaries. He didn't have much of a staff at all, and he didn't have very good generals. Congress hated him. His cabinet thought he was a baboon. This was not very promising for winning the war. He just happened to have a richer and, you know, really more powerful side in the war, and he was able to muster, he was able to convince people that it was a war worth fighting, and partly because of that rhetorical power that he had.
But I think that his achievements are more that he transformed the country than that he transformed the presidency. He used the presidency to transform the country. And when Lincoln said at Gettysburg that there was this new birth of freedom, I mean, that turned out to be true. I mean, he really changed the whole notion of people's relationship to the United States. And in fact, by the end of the 19th century, people were saying, as we do now, the United States is instead of the United States are. And the idea that the United States Constitution guaranteed the fundamental rights to citizens and not just the states, you know, those are ideas that really come out of the experience of the Civil War.
What institutional innovations lived on from Lincoln's presidency? Was it the first major step toward the expansion of the office?
Well, emergency powers. In terms of institutional, you know, there's no new bureau that lasts after, you know, a lot of it goes back to a small government. But he establishes the national principle, as Bruce was saying. And after that, people think of America as as one country. Well, the former Confederacy doesn't. They don't celebrate 4th of July for a long time after that war.
It's extraordinary to this day the way in which the Civil War and that division still governs so much of our politics and so much of, in many parts of the country, people's party identification.
Well, if you look at who voted for George W. Bush, it's the Confederacy plus some NRA states.
Let's move on to the second century, which we call On the World Stage. I'm Ted O'Brien. We're talking about the presidency, its growth, how it was changed by the men who used the office in whatever set of circumstances they found it. And we're doing that with Dr. Kathleen Dalton of Phillips Academy, Bruce Shulman, professor of history and head of the American and New England Studies program at Boston University, and former congressman, now a businessman and a pro bono worker in numerous organizations, Chet Atkins. Presidency begins its second century in a period of rapid industrial growth, increasing immigration, and a beginning voice on the world stage. Who first stands out here, Kathleen? Any ideas?
Well, it's really President McKinley who's the president during the Spanish-American War. So America gains an empire before T.R. becomes president. Now, McKinley was hesitant. He didn't really want to do this, but he felt it was his duty. T.R. is lobbying for it as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. But when T.R. ascends to the presidency in September 1901, he intends to expand even further. He jokes privately about Canada, Greenland. He's got his eye on the Caribbean. But in fact, except for continuing fighting against Filipino independence, he's quite a peaceful president. And so he is most of the time.
Peaceful president, but sets up the whole basis and the economic structure for a period of American imperialism.
Imperialism of free trade, not taking over other countries, but having gunboats handy so that people pay their debts, being a big influence in...
And military governments.
Right. Right, so he begins
imposed by the U.S.
Right, he begins the long history of involvement in Latin America.
With Teddy Roosevelt, we begin to get increasing awareness of presidential power in the matter of foreign policy. That's a change, is it not, from previous presidents?
Well, Seward's folly it has Grant's willing acceptance.
But here's a guy that did he have a foreign policy? I mean, besides speak softly and carry a big stick and the Great White Fleet.
No, T.R. had T.R. was the important peacemaker in the early 20th century. He averted World War I with the Moroccan crisis, settled the Russo-Japanese War. So he really has a view of America as a major world power working for peace. He argues for a League of Nations years before Woodrow Wilson does, and tries to get America in an international conversation. So on the one hand, the Latin American policy is controversial. On the other hand, he's a very effective peacemaker long before Woodrow Wilson thinks of it, and has a less violent foreign policy than Woodrow Wilson.
And really the first American president who sees a very large part of the presidency as governing and controlling America's role on a world stage.
And isn't he the first to travel outside the United States as president?
He certainly is
the first to submerge in a submarine and do all those
fly an airplane.
And strenuously.
Shoot a bear.
Right. No, he goes to Panama to see how that's going, and a lot of his policies imagining what would happen if all these industrialized nations became so powerful that a world war happened. Wouldn't you want an American Navy strong enough to move from the Atlantic to the Pacific? He's the one who fortifies Pearl Harbor, and he's nervous about Japan and Germany. So in terms of prophetic foreign policy, he's incredibly important. And when World War II happens, thank goodness he thought of it.
We're also at the beginning of progressivism. I think that one of the things that's not known really well about that era is just how many socialists there were. I think Debs got a million votes in one of the presidential elections around that time.
Yeah,
and TR is responding to this upswell, isn't he, with his brand of progressivism? What was his domestic impact? What did he add to the presidency with respect to domestic policy?
Well, he asked for a lot of things he didn't get. I mean, he did agree to Pure Food and Drug. If you eat clean food and don't get poisoned by your drugs, you can thank TR and Congress in his time. He lent a lot of support to public playgrounds and federal regulation, trust busting, having the government insist on competitive activity rather than monopolies, which are anti-competitive.
I think by and large, though, the theme for TR's presidency is a theme of an activist federal government and of a federal government that has control over the forces and the power of money and business. And it harkens back to Jackson's struggles, that to some extent the great sort of ebb and flow of the American presidency is whether a private sector, private money and power and business strength is dominant over public power.
Well, it's very important to remember that the free market had created child labor, industrial accidents, polluted water, and TR was against the free market.
Yes, and I think that TR's efforts to restrain the market and his conservation policies also pointed to some of the innovations he made in the office of president himself. I mean, part of the idea of conservation was part of a larger effort to make a professional federal government. And in fact, the idea about conservation was to get rid of all the fraud in land transactions and to have scientifically trained foresters and managers running those resources. And he wanted to create, on the model of some of the great corporations that he was trying to restrain, a skilled, committed government personnel. In fact, created a commission that tried to do that, even to raise the salaries of government bureaucrats. It didn't go very far. The other innovation, I think, has to do with the relations with what we might call today the media. I mean, TR was very cognizant of, well, the bully, what he calls the bully pulpit, but also the role of publicity in the process of governing and making policy, and was in many ways quite adept at manipulating that name again.
He, more creatively than almost any other president to that time, expanded the boundaries of executive power absent the ability to change the underlying laws. The other thing you see in TR's presidency, the beginning of an effort by the president to reach over the head of Congress to the American public, to build public opinion, to force Congress to act in certain ways. And that's certainly a trend that builds, really starting with TR, and builds to a crescendo in many ways with Reagan and Clinton.
All right, let's pass over Woodrow Wilson and World War One, except to note that it resulted in a withdrawal for a time from the affairs of the world, a nation that was tired of Europe's wars, didn't want to get involved again. The failure of the League of Nations that Woodrow Wilson is characterized as desperately trying to get past. And then a Great Depression, a depression that resulted in fascism in Europe and Asia, communism, which began and continued more deeply into totalitarianism, really, in Russia. Franklin Roosevelt elected in the United States. And what does he do? Is it fair to say that he brings about a revolution here?
Oh, I think there's no question that he brought about a revolution in the U.S. And part of that was a statutory revolution, that the just body of law that passed under Roosevelt was really quite extraordinary and unprecedented up to that time. But the other thing was sort of very similar to Lincoln. Roosevelt was the great healer, uniter, person who really infused the soul and spirit of America with a wonderful set of values.
Kathleen Dalton?
Well, he enlarged the federal government and argued, as his fifth cousin did, that the federal government's the best protector of the public interest. And a great many people believed him. And, in fact, they worked to defend, you know, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't have eaten if the federal government hadn't supplemented relief funds. Building American defenses to prepare to fight for World War II. Think about how the world would be different. Because sometimes, you know, it's so common among historians to say, oh, FDR didn't cure the Great Depression. Well, he may not have cured the Great Depression, but if in 1938 or 39, when the world was in crisis, if he hadn't been there, where would the American economy have been in terms of productivity? There probably would have been a revolution. So I think he has to be given credit for saving America domestically and saving the world from Hitler. I mean, this is pretty profound.
He created the preconditions for the successful democratic capitalist state, which is now the dominant form of government in the world and certainly the thing that everybody, virtually every other country, aspires to in one way or another.
And, of course, and I don't think you can't overestimate the way he changed the American people's relationship with their government in the concrete ways, in that people look to Washington for things like Social Security in times of retirement and for defense in times of war and so on, but also in a very personal way. I mean, for more than one generation, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt was the president, the very idea of what a president should look like and act like. And when you go to the Roosevelt Library and you see the just bushels of letters written by people to FDR saying, you know, thank you for the WPA and all of them other A's. Clearly, that was just something that no one would ever have thought of doing because they didn't have that kind of relationship.
World War II is over. Europe and Asia are a shambles. The old European colonial system is crumbling. The U.S. is virtually untouched. It is the beginning of Pax Americana. Or is it? How do the subsequent presidents react? Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson.
Well, they mostly accept the fact that the world's polarized around the Cold War and that a military establishment has to, you know, is central to American life, and that gives the presidency way more power than it's ever had before. Truman's going to be debated for a long time about whether or not he could have mediated early in the Cold War and calmed things down a little bit. But probably Stalin was going to be a formidable foe.
I don't think very many people realistically think that Harry Truman could have talked Joseph Stalin down.
He tried. He said he liked old Joe and he thought he could get along with him. After he got across from him and saw about keep your agreements and this won't happen, as he remembered it. But is this a time of presidential dominance or congressional acquiescence? What's going on here?
It's certainly a period. The very nature of the Cold War and the nature of the threat that we faced, that placed enormous power on national security issues in the presidency and established for a period of time a bipartisanship in foreign affairs that was something quite new and something that I think was extraordinarily important in America's eventual victory in the Cold War.
Politics ends at the water's edge.
The structure of the modern presidency, the assumption that the president would have control over two big areas of government, foreign policy and managing the national economy, that comes right out of the post-war era. And in fact, it's codified in legislation, the Atomic Energy Act, the National Security Act, the Full Employment Act, which all devolve onto the president not only the responsibility for managing foreign policy and economic policy, but create a whole new alphabet soup of post-New Deal agencies to do just that, including the CIA, the NSC, the National Security Council, the Council of Economic Advisers, and so on, all of which are lodged in the White House or overseen entirely by the executive branch without congressional oversight until Watergate.
But this is the creation of the National Security State and the Imperial Presidency.
For you, all of you, Kathleen Dalton, Bruce Shulman, Chet Atkins, who stands out as the most influential president? Was it Truman, who at times saw his ratings approval drop to 23%? Johnson, reviled because of the Vietnam War? Eisenhower, with the peace prosperity in that tense time? Or Kennedy, because of his legend?
You mean influential in terms of shaping history?
I would say so, or shaping the way we think about the presidency, too, shaping the presidency as it moved through time.
Well, I think in terms of shaping the American people's relationship with the presidency, it might have been Kennedy. He was there for a very, very brief period of time, but again, this enormous sense of connection, and for a period of time everybody was sort of defined by their relationship to Kennedy and to the Kennedy myth, if you will, the Camelot myth. In many ways, Eisenhower was a bland and a consensus figure, so he doesn't capture the American imagination, but the things that Eisenhower did in terms of restraining the military, in terms of at a time in our life when the so-called military-industrial complex could have become totally dominant given the whole apparatus of the national security state, I think Eisenhower's role was extraordinarily important in that and very, very unrecognized.
Well, I think Kennedy is really important because of unleashing idealism and nationalism at a time when Americans were kind of in the doldrums, and they imagined that they could be a great society, and it took Lyndon Johnson to come in and actually put it into law. But that sense of America being able to look at its own domestic capacity and to be a better society, Kennedy defined that
and
agenda.
The sense of American possibility.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Shulman.
I don't know. I've written a book about Lyndon Johnson, so I suppose that gives me a certain jaded point of view about this. But I think that if you look at the presidency since Lincoln and you ask, okay, at which moments, which are the most fertile moments in terms of making Americans the people we are and the nation we are today? Well, it's the New Deal era of Franklin Roosevelt, and it's the mid-60s under Lyndon Johnson. The Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act really transform our sense of ourselves as a nation. Even lesser-known things like the immigration reform, which got rid of the odious quota system that had been in effect since the 1920s and set the stage for the immigration from Asia and Latin America that has really transformed Boston and all of America since then. Medicare and the kind of the fundamental building blocks of the modern welfare state. So, and even the sense of a national community, a sense that has now, I think, declined very much.
But in part, Bruce, if I may, it was blown apart by the destructiveness and the of the Vietnam War and the reaction and the difficulty that seemed to ring down the curtain on that great society at that point.
And that's true, and that's why Johnson's reputation sank so low at a time when, for instance, Truman and Eisenhower's while they were in office, their reputations weren't so good, but their reputation has come up. Johnson's sank very low in all the ratings. He was even rated worst on the scale of morality below Richard Nixon by a poll 5 years ago. But in the last 2 or 3 years, I think because the Cold War is behind us, because the Vietnam generation is sort of reaching maturity, I mean, I think in the last, if you listen to the rhetoric in last year's presidential election, Johnson was invoked by name by Al Gore and by many of the other candidates as a model.
But in the immediate aftermath of Johnson and then Nixon, did they so discredit the presidency that the focus of American politics pointed elsewhere? Was the presidency still imperial in the wake of Watergate? Or had the American people sort of backed away from it and looked elsewhere for direction?
Well, I think Congress in the 1970s really tried to stand on its hind legs and set some limits on the imperial presidency with the War Powers Act. And Watergate is really the classic case study of how checks and balances can work. Congress really stood up to Nixon and said, you can't do all these illegal things. We won't let you. We stand for the American people. So I don't think Congress really became ascendant. I think the presidency still really matters, but I think we've been floundering morally since Watergate, and we really haven't put our full faith in the presidency since then.
But the shift hasn't been of power from the presidency to the Congress or to other branches. I mean, I think you're right. The campaign finance reform after Watergate, we've seen how well that has worked. The War Powers Resolution, the Ethics in Government Act. I think that it's not so much that the Congress reeled in the presidency as that instead now people are relying more on institutions outside of government, principally on the market for good or ill, as sort of the agent of social change and accomplishment.
That's Professor Bruce Shulman of the American and New England Studies Program at Boston University, professor of history as well. And he and Dr. Kathleen Dalton of Phillips Academy and former Congressman Chet Atkins, now businessman, are talking about the presidency. So where are we today? The second century ends in 1988, and the third begins with George Bush Sr.
Yeah.
And then Clinton, who's impeached but not convicted. And now George W. Bush.
Well, I think we're digging out from under the immense load of garbage that Bill Clinton left when he left the White House. That
he did leave something, Chet?
No, man. Yeah,
he did?
A few towels he couldn't find. And
and an immense
some
load
of the
of
china
garbage.
He didn't swipe. But the difficult thing there, and I think whatever your partisan persuasion is, it's just an enormous embarrassment. And Clinton did so many things right, and he was such a wonderful steward of the economy. And just to leave, you know, taking every gift you could, the rich pardon, and swiping the towels, it just, I think, leaves everybody with a very unsettled feeling about the presidency.
I would think that it would be a very good beginning for George W. Bush, the not Clinton.
Oh, I think it's Bill Clinton on the way out of the White House gave George W. Bush as nice a gift as any incoming president. All he has to do is not swipe things in the White House
to
look pretty good.
I don't agree with that. I think that George W. Bush is going to have to do something as president, and he's promised to be a centrist. He wasn't really elected. The judgment of history on him, I think these little things about Clinton and his clearly almost sick sexual preoccupations. Who knows how history is going to judge Bill Clinton? You know how people will seek a balance. It's clearly the bad taste is with us now. But George W. Bush is he's not a legitimate president in the minds of many people. And his party really stood there and said, we don't care about those 19,000 votes. Jesse, the head of the Republican National Committee, stood on national television and said, it's irrational for those people to be demonstrating. So I think there's a certain disconnect between his being in the White House and democratic processes. And so, I mean, I think he has a big agenda, which is he has to establish himself as a reasonable president.
Professor Shulman, crises of legitimacy were for time past. His fraudulency, he was called, Rutherford B. Hayes, when he got every single electoral vote and lost the popular vote. Kevin Phillips pointed out recently that the three preceding presidents who lost the popular vote were one-termers, John Quincy Adams, Benjamin Harrison, and Rutherford B. Hayes, who did not attempt to refashion as if they had a mandate. How does a historian react to this? I know in law schools they're debating the Supreme Court decision up and down now.
Well, how do we react to it? I think that in all those three cases, of course, the losing opponent went out on the campaign trail pretty much immediately, and the election didn't stop. And, of course, in those three, and well, at least in the cases of Jackson and against John Quincy Adams and Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison, the defeated candidate then took back the presidency in the next election. I think, though, this situation is very different, and to some extent it's different because of what's happened in the wake of Bill Clinton, as Chet was suggesting, which is that one of the things that Bill Clinton completes, he doesn't accomplish it all by himself, but he completes, is that the president is now a celebrity. He is a celebrity in the way a movie star or a pop star is. We know about his personal life. We care about the clothes he wears, his hairstyle, his wife's hairstyle, and so on. And there, the office has been sort of demystified and disenchanted in that way. We're invited back behind the curtains. We tour the White House. And I think so George W. Bush is going to have to, whether he likes it or not, and he clearly doesn't like it, he's going to have to be a celebrity as well as a president. I don't think we're going to put that genie back into the box.
What about the idea that this is an illegitimate presidency? How does that...
Well, I think that the American people and many people were troubled by the way the presidential vote played itself out. And we are finding, as the news media are now going back under Freedom of Information Act and recounting the votes, that there's a very, very high likelihood, based on independent analysis, that Al Gore, in fact, won the popular vote in Florida, which would have given him the electoral vote. But that aside, I think it's extraordinary that the American people have been willing to have, if you will, a willing suspension of disbelief, to say we're not served well as a country by a crisis of illegitimacy. And people, and I think the Congress, the news media, the general public, have been willing to give Bush a honeymoon, been willing to say whatever it was, whatever differences we had in the outcome of that election, it does not serve us as a country to spend the next 4 years debating about the legitimacy of his holding that office. And I think that's a very mature and positive development for us.
I don't think that means that they necessarily have to or even should, for political reasons, kind of roll over and lie down before him. I mean, that is, they can say, hey, you said you were going to govern in the middle as a moderate. You're not doing it. We're going to hold you to it.
Absolutely. And I think that's the struggle on this enormous tax cut that Bush is putting through. And I think it's interesting that people, rather than going after his legitimacy, are going after any of the Democrats who might be inclined to support that tax cut. And, of course, that's what put through the Reagan tax cuts in the 80s.
Well, my interest historically is in seeing what comes of this election in the long run. Will people become more cynical as they did after Vietnam and Watergate and say, I'm staying home, my vote doesn't count, they don't really listen, they don't really care, the voting machine will break anyway? Or will they get organized and go state by state, county by county, and fight for electoral reform? Now, I guess my disappointment in Bill Clinton and Al Gore is, okay, folks, shouldn't you have been out there trying to get those ballots fixed? And shouldn't you trying to go make sure that equal protection of the law, which the Supreme Court worried about for recounts but not voting, shouldn't they, as leaders of the Democratic Party, work together to get those votes counted?
On that note, let me ask a couple of more questions as we come to the end of the program. Over this two-century history, it seems that there's just about every 70 years we get like a really great president. Washington in 1788, Lincoln in 1860, Roosevelt again in the 30s. He died in 1945. Are we due to get another great president anytime soon?
I sure hope so.
I sure hope not. because I'd like us to get some very good ones, but I think that our standards for greatness have to do with navigating successfully through truly horrific crises, moments at which the fate of the nation, if not the world, is at stake. Fortunately, FDR and Lincoln did that very well. But if we could, but I'm not so sure I'm willing to take the chance with some of the guys we put in there.
Kathleen?
Well, I'm really ready for an American Gandhi. I like somebody who's selfless, not materialistic, who's got his sexual impulses under control, who's going to work for the American people, rich and poor. None of this capital gains tax break for the rich. Where is our American Gandhi? Well, and I just don't see him.
Yeah, Gandhi never would have made it through the nominating process. I guess I would disagree with Bruce a little bit. I think that we are in a time of immense international threat in terms of the planet itself, in terms of global warming, in terms of the population crisis, in terms of the vast difference on the face of the earth between the rich and the poor, the growing differences in this country, and how power is used and divided on the planet. And I think, and to some extent, I think Kathleen's right on target, that it is a time that calls for a Gandhi-like figure who can bring us beyond where we are, in a sense, and can bring us on that wonderful march, Gandhi's march to the sea. Unfortunately, I don't see our political process as being something that's conducive to picking that kind of leader.
But deliberately so. We don't want the charismatic, great Pied Piper of Hamelin, the king, the prince, the leader of the people. We want checks and balances, and not this far and not that far.
But Gandhi was a person of checks and balances, a person of immense limitations, and not an outlandish, charismatic figure. In many ways, charismatic because he was so anti-charismatic.
All right, we're really running into trouble now as we head toward the end. Very briefly, as we look back over the whole history, I'll start with you, Dr. Dalton. Your picks for the greatest five presidents?
Well, FDR, certainly. It's a lot to save America and the world in four terms. I really think T.R. is a very important president. Obviously, I would think that conservation was not a really popular issue before he became president, and he made some very serious mistakes, his Latin American policy, for one. But he really was passionately committed to improving American life and domestic reform. I give Lyndon Johnson my third place, partly because even though he got stuck with the Vietnam War, which he did not start, he wanted to make a great society, and he had an immense idealistic vision, even if it's partly Kennedy's. Who do we
okay,
go?
Okay, that's three.
That's three.
Fine.
That's good. Okay.
In the time we have.
Well, I think, you know, I hate to say it, but I think I'm going to have to just, you know, cheerlead on the conventional choices. I mean, FDR, I think, belongs there. Abraham Lincoln, of course. TR, I think you can even make the case for Washington or Jefferson. I'm a fan of Lyndon Johnson, as I've said here, and I think we can avoid the cynical choice, which is William Henry Harrison, who only served 3.5 weeks, and so did relatively little damage.
Thank you for avoiding the cynical choice. Chip.
I really think it's a useless and destructive exercise to sort of pick. We have this sort of American instinct to rate things and rank them and so forth. So much of the presidency is a function of luck, of the crises that you faced, and also of our particular view at a point in time. One of the things that I think would be a very constructive exercise is to look at the American presidents who have done most to advance this country in terms of racial tolerance. And the interesting thing is how sort of many of the people like Wilson, who was viewed at some points as a great president, is, I think, fortunately today viewed as a terrible president in large measure because he was so bigoted and so destructive nationally in the issue of race.
Definition of humanity was too cramped to allow him a place in the pantheon. Well, thank you very much. Does anyone want to try to summarize what we've been talking about on this President's Day weekend? Whither the presidency? Where is the presidency going?
I think probably the most honest answer is we don't have a clue. That it's an absolutely marvelous institution that has kept this country together through some very difficult and turbulent times. And whatever it is, we seem to have people who fill the vacuum at the important periods in our life.
Bruce Schulman?
Well, I just have to agree with Chet on that. I mean, it's historians argue enough about what already happened, and we're notoriously bad prophets of the future. So I've made some notably bad predictions in my career, so I'm going to pass.
Well, one thing we've learned from the past is that people rise to the office sometimes. People learn on the job. They get advice. I guess if our current occupant needed advice, I'd say be very careful about security and listen to both sides.
Thank you very much. Our guests have been Bruce Schulman, professor at Boston University, Dr. Kathleen Dalton of Phillips Academy, and Chet Atkins, former congressman, now a businessman. You've been listening to Boston University World of Ideas roundtable discussion on the history of the American presidency. Join us next week when we will present a speech delivered here at the university by Brent Scowcroft, the former National Security Advisor under George Bush Sr., on the 10th anniversary of the war with Iraq. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Ben Walker, Stephen Belter, and Bob Zalisk. Our webmaster is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence.